at arms, and the gunfire began dwindling. We had to wait for the word to go all the way around. Then we crashed the door. The first floor was ankle-deep with booze that was still gurgling from bullet holes in the stacked-up cases and barrels that filled most of the house. Dizzy with the fumes of spilled hooch, we waded around until we had found four dead bodies and no live ones. The four were swarthy, foreign-looking men in laborer's clothes. Two of them were practically shot to pieces. Noonan said, "Leave them here and get out." His voice was cheerful, but in a flashlight's glow his eyes showed white-ringed with fear. We went out gladly, though I did hesitate long enough to pocket an unbroken bottle labeled Dewar. A khaki-dressed copper was tumbling off a motorcycle at the gate. He yelled at us, "The First National's been stuck up!" Noonan cursed savagely, bawled, "He's foxed us, damn him! Back to town, everybody!" Everybody except us who had ridden with the chief beat it for the machines. Two of them took the dead detective with them. Noonan looked at me out of his eye corners and said, "This is a tough one, no foolin'." I said, "Well," shrugged, and sauntered over to his car where the driver was sitting at the wheel. I stood with my back to the house, talking to Pat. I don't remember what we talked about. Presently, Noonan and the other sleuths joined us. Only a little flame showed through the open roadhouse door before we passed out of sight around the bend in the road. Chapter 16. Exit Jerry. There was a mob around the First National Bank. We pushed through it to the door where we found sour-faced McGraw.
"Was six of them, masked," he reported to the chief as we went inside. "They hit at about 2:30. Five of them got away clean with the jack. The watchman here dropped one of them, Jerry Hooper. He's over on the bench, cold. We got the roads blocked, and I wired around if it ain't too late. Last seen of them was when they made the turn into King Street in a black Lincoln."
We went over to look at the dead Jerry, lying on one of the lobby benches with a brown robe over him. The bullet had gone under his left shoulder blade. The bank watchman, a harmless-looking old duffer, pushed up his chest and told us about it.
"There wasn't no chance to do nothing at first. They were in for anybody knew anything. And maybe they didn't work fast. Right down the line, scooping it up. No chance to do anything then. But I says to myself, 'All righty, young fellas, you've got it all your own way now, but wait till you try to leave.' And I was as good as my word, you bet you. I runs right to the door after them and cut loose with the old firearm. I got that fella just as he was stepping into the car. I bet you I'd have got more of them if I'd had more cartridges, because it's kind of hard shooting down like that, standing in the—"
Noonan stopped the monologue by patting the old duffer's back till his lungs were empty, telling him,
"That certainly is fine. That certainly is fine."
McGraw pulled the robe up over the dead man again and growled,
"Nobody can identify anybody. But with Jerry on it, it's a cinch it was Whisper's caper."
The chief nodded happily and said,
"I'll leave it in your hands, Mac. Going to poke around here or going back to the hall with me?" he asked me.
"Neither. I've got a date, and I want to get into dry shoes." Dinah Brand's little Marmon was standing in front of the hotel. I didn't see her. I went up to my room, leaving the door unlocked. I had got my hat and coat off when she came in without knocking.
"My God, you keep a boozy-smelling room," she said.
"It's my shoes. Noonan took me wading in rum." She crossed to the window, opened it, sat on the sill, and asked,
"What was that for?"
"He thought he was going to find your Max out in a dump called Cedar Hill Inn. So we went out there, shot the joint silly, murdered some dagos, spilled gallons of liquor, and left the place burning."
"Cedar Hill Inn? I thought it had been closed up for a year or more."
"It looked it, but it was somebody's warehouse."
"But you didn't find Max there?"
she asked. "While we were there, he seems to have been knocking over Elihu's First National Bank."
"I saw that,"
she said. I had just come out of Bengren's, the store two doors away. I had just gotten my car when I saw a big boy backing out of the bank carrying a sack and a gun with a black handkerchief over his face.
Was Max with them?
No, he wouldn't be. He'd send Jerry and the boys. That's what he has them for. Jerry was there. I knew him as soon as he got out of the car, in spite of the black handkerchief. They all had black ones. Four of them came out of the bank, running down to the car at the curb. Jerry and another fellow were in the car. When the four came across the sidewalk, Jerry jumped out and went to meet them. That's when the shooting started and Jerry dropped. The others jumped in the bus and lit out. How about that dough you owe me?
I counted out 10 $20 bills and a dime. She left the window to come for them.
That's for pulling Dan off so you could cop Max, she said when she had stowed the money away in her bag. Now how about what I was to get for showing you where you could turn up the dope on his killing Tim Noonan?
You'll have to wait till he's indicted. How do I know the dope's any good? She frowned and asked.
What do you do with all the money you don't spend?
Her face brightened.
You know where Max is now?
No.
What's it worth to know?
Nothing.
I'll tell you for $100.
I wouldn't want to take advantage of you that way.
I'll tell you for $50.
I shook my head.
25.
I don't want him, I said. I don't care where he is. Why don't you peddle the news to Noonan?
Yes, and try to collect. Do you only perfume yourself with booze, or is there any for drinking purposes?
Here's a bottle of so-called Dewar that I picked up at Cedar Hill this afternoon. There's a bottle of King George in my bag. What's your choice? She voted for King George. We had a drink apiece, straight, and I said, sit down and play with it while I change clothes. When I came out of the bathroom 25 minutes later, she was sitting at the secretary, smoking a cigarette and studying a memoranda book that had been in a side pocket of my Gladstone bag.
I guess these are the expenses you've charged up on other cases, she said without looking up. I'm damned if I can see why you can't be more liberal with me. Look, here's a $600 item marked INF. That's information you bought from somebody, isn't it? And here's $150 below it. Top, whatever that is. And here's another day when you spent nearly $1,000.
They must be telephone numbers, I said, taking the book from her.
Where were you raised, fanning my baggage? I was raised in a convent, she told me. I won the Good Behavior Prize every year I was there. I thought little girls who put extra spoons of sugar in their chocolate went to hell for gluttony. I didn't even know there was such a thing as profanity until I was 18. The first time I heard any, I damn near fainted.
She spit on the rug in front of her, tilted her chair back, put her crossed feet on my bed, and asked,
"What do you think of that?"
I pushed her feet off the bed and said, "I was raised in a waterfront saloon. Keep your saliva off my floor or I'll toss you out on your neck."
"Let's have another drink first. Listen, what'll you give me for the inside story of how the boys didn't lose anything building the city hall? The story that was in the papers I sold Donald Wilson."
That doesn't click with me. Try another.
How about why the first Mrs. Lou Yard was sent to the insane asylum?
No.
King, our sheriff, $8,000 in debt 4 years ago, now the owner of as nice a collection of downtown business blocks as you'd want to see. I can't give you all of it, but I can show you where to get it.
Keep trying, I encouraged her.
No. You don't want to buy anything. You're just hoping you'll pick up something for nothing. This isn't bad scotch. Where'd you get it?
Brought it from San Francisco with me.
What's the idea of not wanting any of this information I'm offering? Think you can get it cheaper?
Information of that kind's not much good to me now. I've got to move quick. I need dynamite, something to blow them apart. She laughed and jumped up, her big eyes sparkling.
I've got one of Lou Yard's cards. Suppose we send the bottle of Dewar you copped to Pete with the card. wouldn't he take it as a declaration of war? If Cedar Hill was a liquor cache, it was Pete's. Wouldn't the bottle and lose card make him think Noonan had knocked the place over under orders?
I considered it and said, too crude. It wouldn't fool him. Besides, I'd just as leave have Pat and Lou both against the chief at this stage. She pouted and said,
you think you know everything. You're just hard to get along with. Take me out tonight? I've got a new outfit that'll knock them cockeyed.
Yeah.
Come up for me around 8.
She patted my cheek with a warm hand, said ta-ta, and went out as the telephone bell began jingling.
My Chinch and Dix are together at your client's joint, Mickey Linehan reported over the wire. Mine's been generally busier than a hustler with 2 bunks, though I don't know what the score is yet. Anything new?
I said there wasn't and went into conference with myself across the bed, trying to guess what would come of Noonan's attack on Cedar Hill Inn and whispers on the First National Bank. I would have given something for the ability to hear what was being said up at old Elihu's house by him, Pete the Finn, and Lou Yard. But I hadn't that ability, and I was never much good at guessing, so after 30 minutes I stopped tormenting my brain and took a nap. It was nearly 7 o'clock when I came out of the nap. I washed, dressed, loaded my pockets with a gun and a pint flask of scotch, and went up to Dinah's.
Chapter 17. Reno. She took me into her living room, backed away from me, revolved, and asked me how I liked the new dress. I said I liked it. She explained that the color was rose beige and that the dinguses on the side were something or other, winding up.
And you really think I look good in it?
You always look good, I said. Lou Yard and Pete the Finn went calling on old Elihu this afternoon. She made a face at me and said,
you don't give a damn about my dress. What did they do there?
A powwow, I suppose. She looked at me through her lashes and asked,
don't you really know where Max is?
Then I did. There was no use admitting I hadn't known all along. I said, at Wilson's, probably, but I haven't been interested enough to make sure.
That's goofy of you. He's got reasons for not liking you and me. Take Mama's advice and nail him quick, if you like living and like having Mama live, too.
I laughed and said, you don't know the worst of it. Max didn't kill Noonan's brother. Tim didn't say Max. He tried to say McSwain and died before he could finish. She grabbed my shoulders and tried to shake my 190 pounds. She was almost strong enough to do it.
God damn you!
Her breath was hot in my face. Her face was white as her teeth. Rouge stood out sharply like red labels pasted on her mouth and cheeks.
If you framed him and made me frame him, you've got to kill him, now!
I don't like being manhandled, even by young women who look like something out of mythology when they're steamed up. I took her hands off my shoulders and said, stop belly aching. You're still alive.
Yes, still. But I know Max better than you. I know how much chance anybody that frames him has got of staying alive long. It would be bad enough if we had got him right, but...
Don't make so much fuss over it. I've framed millions and nothing's happened to me. Get your hat and coat and we'll feed. You'll feel better then.
You're crazy if you think I'm going out. Not with that.
Stop it, sister. If he's that dangerous, he's just as likely to get you here as anywhere. So what difference does it make?
It makes a... You know what you're going to do? You're going to stay here until Max is put out of the way. It's your fault, and you've got to look out for me. I haven't even got Dan. He's in the hospital.
I can't, I said. I've got work to do. You're all burnt up over nothing. Max has probably forgotten all about you by now. Get your hat and coat. I'm starving.
She put her face close to mine again, and her eyes looked as if they had found something horrible in mine.
"Oh, you're rotten," she said. "You don't give a damn what happens to me. You're using me as you use the others, that dynamite you wanted. I trusted you."
"You're dynamite, all right, but the rest of it's kind of foolish. You look a lot better when you're happy. Your features are heavy. Anger makes them downright brutal. I'm starving, sister."
"You'll eat here," she said. "You're not going to get me out after dark."
She meant it. She swapped the rose-beige dress for an apron and took inventory of the icebox. There were potatoes, lettuce, canned soup, and half a fruitcake. I went out and got a couple of steaks, rolls, asparagus, and tomatoes. When I came back, she was mixing gin, vermouth, and orange bitters in a quart shaker, not leaving a lot of space for them to move around in.
"Did you see anything?" she asked.
I sneered at her in a friendly way. We carried the cocktails into the dining room and played bottoms up while the meal cooked. The drinks cheered her a lot. By the time we sat down to the food, she had almost forgotten her fright. She wasn't a very good cook, but we ate as if she were. We put a couple of gin ginger ales in on top the dinner. She decided she wanted to go places and do things. No lousy little runt could keep her cooped up, because she had been as square with him as anybody could be until he got nasty over nothing, and if he didn't like what she did, he could go climb trees or jump in lakes, and we'd go out to the Silver Arrow where she had meant to take me, because she had promised Reno she'd show up at his party, and by God she would, and anybody who thought she wouldn't was crazy as a pet cuckoo, and what did I think of that? "Who's Reno?" I asked, while she tied herself tighter in the apron by pulling the strings the wrong way.
"Reno Starkey. You'll like him. He's a right guy. I promised him I'd show at his celebration, and that's just what I'll do."
"What's he celebrating?"
"What the hell's the matter with this lousy apron? He was sprung this afternoon."
"Turn around and I'll unwind you. What was he in for? Stand still."
"Blowing a safe 6 or 7 months ago. Turlock's, the jeweler. Reno, Put Collings, Blackie Whalen, Hank O'Mara, and a little lame guy called Step and a Half. They had plenty of cover. Lou Yard. But the Jewelers Association dicks tied the job to them last week. So Noonan had to go through the motions. It doesn't mean anything. They got out on bail at 5 o'clock this afternoon, and that's the last anybody will ever hear about it. Reno's used to it. He was already out on bail for 3 other capers. Suppose you mix another little drink while I'm inserting myself in the dress."
The Silver Arrow was halfway between Personville and Mock Lake.
"It's not a bad dump," Dinah told me as her little Marmon carried us toward it. "Polly DeVoto is a good scout, and anything she sells you is good, except maybe the bourbon. That always tastes a little bit like it had been drained off a corpse. You'll like her. You can get away with anything out here so long as you don't get noisy. She won't stand for noise. There it is. See the red and blue lights through the trees?"
We rode out of the woods into full view of the roadhouse, a very electric-lighted imitation castle set close to the road. "What do you mean she won't stand for noise?" I asked, listening to the chorus of pistols singing bang, bang, bang.
"Something up," the girl muttered, stopping the car.
2 men dragging a woman between them ran out of the roadhouse's front door, ran away into the darkness. A man sprinted out a side door, away. The guns sang on. I didn't see any flashes. Another man broke out and vanished around the back. A man leaned far out a front second-story window, a black gun in his hand. Dinah blew her breath out sharply. From a hedge by the road, a flash of orange pointed briefly up at the man in the window. His gun flashed downward. He leaned farther out. No second flash came from the hedge. The man in the window put a leg over the sill, bent, hung by his hands, dropped. Our car jerked forward. Dinah's lower lip was between her teeth. The man who had dropped from the window was gathering himself up on hands and knees. Dinah put her face in front of mine and screamed, "Reno!" The man jumped up, his face to us. He made the road in three leaps as we got to him. Dinah had the little Mormon wide open before Reno's feet were on the running board beside me. I wrapped my arms around him, and damn near dislocated them, holding him on. He made it as tough as he could for me by leaning out to try for a shot at the guns that were tossing lead all around us. Then it was all over. We were out of range, sight, and sound of the Silver Arrow, speeding away from Personville. Reno turned around and did his own holding on. I took my arms in and found that all the joints still worked. Dinah was busy with the car. Reno said, "Thanks, kid. I needed pulling out."
"That's all right," she told him. "So that's the kind of parties you throw?"
"We had guests that wasn't invited. You know the Tanner Road?"
"Yes."
"Take it. It'll put us over to Mountain Boulevard, and we can get back to town that-a-way."
The girl nodded, slowed up a little, and asked, "Who were the uninvited guests?"
"Some plugs that don't know enough to leave me alone."
"Do I know them?"
she asked too casually as she turned the car into a narrower and rougher road.
"Let it alone, kid," Reno said. "Better get as much out of the heap as it's got."
She prodded another 15 miles an hour out of the Mormon. She had plenty to do now holding the car to the road, and Reno had plenty holding himself to the car. Neither of them made any more conversation until the road brought us into one that had more and better paving. Then he asked,
"So you paid Whisper off?"
"Mm-hmm."
"They're saying you turned rat on him."
"They would. What do you think?"
"Ditching him was all right. But throwing in with a dick and cracking the works to him is kind of sour. Damn sour, if you ask me."
He looked at me while he said it. He was a man of 34 or 35, fairly tall, broad and heavy without fat. His eyes were large, brown, dull, and set far apart in a long, slightly sallow horse face. It was a humorless face, stolid, but somehow not unpleasant. I looked at him and said nothing. The girl said,
"If that's the way you feel about it, you can..."
"Look out!" Reno grunted.
We had swung around a curve. A long black car was straight across the road ahead of us, a barricade. Bullets flew around us. Reno and I threw bullets around while the girl made a polo pony of the little Mormon. She shoved it over to the left of the road, let the left wheels ride the bank high, crossed the road again with Reno's and my weight on the inside. Got the right bank under the left wheels just as our side of the car began to lift in spite of our weight, slid us down in the road with our backs to the enemy, and took us out of the neighborhood by the time we had emptied our guns. A lot of people had done a lot of shooting, but so far as we could tell, nobody's bullets had hurt anybody. Reno, holding to the door with his elbows while he pushed another clip into his automatic, said,
"Nice work, kid. You handle the bus like you meant it."
Dinah asked,
"Where now?"
"Far away first. Just follow the road. We'll have to figure it out. Looks like they got the burg closed up on us. Keep your dog on it."
We put 10 or 12 more miles between Personville and us. We passed a few cars, saw nothing to show we were being chased. A short bridge rumbled under us. Reno said,
"Take the right turn at the top of the hill."
We took it. Into a dirt road that wound between trees down the side of a rock-ridged hill. 10 miles an hour was fast going here. After 5 minutes of creeping along, Reno ordered a halt. We heard nothing, saw nothing during the half-hour we sat in darkness. Then Reno said,
"There's an empty shack 1 mile down the road. We'll camp there, huh? There's no sense trying to crash the city line again tonight."
Dinah said she would prefer anything to being shot at again. I said it was all right with me, though I would rather have tried to find some path back to the city. We followed the dirt track cautiously until our headlights settled on a small clapboard building that badly needed the paint it had never got.
"Is this it?"
Dinah asked Reno.
"Uh-huh. Stay here till I look it over."
He left us, appearing soon in the beam of our lights at the shack door. He fumbled with keys at the padlock, got it off, opened the door, and went in. Presently, he came to the door and called, "All right, come in and make yourselves at home." Dinah cut off the engine and got out of the car. "Is there a flashlight in the car?" I asked. She said, "Yes," gave it to me, yawned. "My God, I'm tired. I hope there's something to drink in the hole." I told her I had a flask of scotch. The news cheered her up. The shack was a one-room affair that held an army cot covered with brown blankets, a deal table with a deck of cards and some gummy poker chips on it, a brown iron stove, four chairs, an oil lamp, dishes, pots, pans, and buckets, three shelves with canned food on them, a pile of firewood, and a wheelbarrow. Rena was lighting the lamp when we came in. He said, "Not so tough. I'll hide the heap, and then we'll be all set till daylight." Dinah went over to the cot, turned back the covers, and reported,
"Maybe there's things in it, but anyway, it's not alive with them. Now let's have that drink."
I unscrewed the flask and passed it to her while Rena went out to hide the car. When she had finished, I took a shot. The purr of the Marmon's engine got fainter. I opened the door and looked out. Downhill, through trees and bushes, I could see broken chunks of white light going away. When I lost them for good, I returned indoors and asked the girl, "Have you ever had to walk home before?"
"What?"
"Reno's gone with the car."
"The lousy tramp! Thank God he left us where there's a bed, anyway."
"That'll get you nothing."
"No?"
"No. Reno had a key to this dump. 10 to 1, the birds after him know about it. That's why he ditched us here. We're supposed to argue with them, hold them off his trail a while." She got up wearily from the cot, cursed Reno, me, all men from Adam on, and said disagreeably,
"You know everything. What do we do next?"
"We find a comfortable spot in the great open spaces, not too far away, and wait to see what happens."
"I'm going to take the blankets."
"Maybe one won't be missed, but you'll tip our mitts if you take more than that."
"Damn your mitts,"
she grumbled, but she took only one blanket. I blew out the lamp, padlocked the door behind us, and with the help of the flashlight, picked away through the undergrowth. On the hillside above, we found a little hollow from which road and shack could be not too dimly seen through foliage thick enough to hide us unless we showed a light. I spread that blanket there, and we settled down. The girl leaned against me and complained that the ground was damp, that she was cold in spite of her fur coat, that she had a cramp in her leg, and that she wanted a cigarette. I gave her another drink from the flask. That brought me 10 minutes of peace. Then she said,
"I'm catching cold. By the time anybody comes, if they ever do, I'll be sneezing and coughing loud enough to be heard in the city."
"Just once," I told her. "Then you'll be all strangled."
"There's a mouse or something crawling under the blanket."
"Probably only a snake."
"Are you married?"
"Don't start that."
"Then you are."
"No."
"I'll bet your wife's glad of it."
I was trying to find a suitable comeback to that wisecrack when a distant light gleamed up the road. It disappeared as I shh-shhed the girl.
"What is it?"
she asked. "A light. It's gone now. Our visitors have left their car and are finishing the trip afoot." A lot of time went by. The girl shivered with her cheek warm against mine. We heard footsteps. Saw dark figures moving on the road and round the shack without being sure whether we did or didn't. A flashlight ended our doubt by putting a bright circle on the shack's door. A heavy voice said, "We'll let the broad come out." There was a half minute of silence while they waited for a reply from indoors. Then the same heavy voice asked, "Coming?" Then more silence. Gunfire, a familiar sound tonight, broke the silence. Something hammered boards.
"Come on," I whispered to the girl. "We'll have a try at their car while they're making a racket." "Let them alone," she said, pulling my arm down as I started up. "I've had enough of it for one night. We're all right here."
"Come on," I insisted. she said. I won't. And she wouldn't, and presently, while we argued, it was too late. The boys below had kicked in the door, found the hut empty, and were bellowing for their car. It came, took 8 men aboard, and followed Reno's track downhill. We might as well move in again, I said. It's not likely they'll be back this way tonight. I hope to God there's some scotch left in that flask, she said, as I helped her stand up. Chapter 18. Painter Street. The shack's supply of canned goods didn't include anything that tempted us for breakfast. We made the meal of coffee cooked in very stale water from a galvanized pail. A mile of walking brought us to a farmhouse where there was a boy who didn't mind earning a few dollars by driving us to town in the family Ford. He had a lot of questions to which we gave him phony answers or none. He set us down in front of a little restaurant in Upper King Street where we ate quantities of buckwheat cakes and bacon. A taxi put us at Dinah's door a little before 9 o'clock. I searched the place for her from roof to cellar and found no signs of visitors. When will you be back? She asked as she followed me to the door. I'll try to pop in between now and midnight, if only for a few minutes. Where does Lou Yard live?
1622 Painter Street. Painter's 3 blocks over. 1622's 4 blocks up. What are you gonna do there?
Before I could answer, she put her hands on my arm and begged,
Get Max, will you? I'm afraid of him.
Maybe I'll sick Noonan on him a little later. It depends on how things work out. She called me a damned double-crossing something or other who didn't care what happened to her as long as his dirty work got done. I went over to Painter Street. 1622 was a red brick house with a garage under the front porch. A block up the street, I found Dick Foley in a hired drive-yourself Buick. I got in beside him, asking, What's doing?
Spot 2. Out 3:30, office to Wilson's. Mickey, 5, home, busy, kept plant. Off 3:07. Nothing yet.
That was supposed to inform me that he had picked up Lou Yard at 2 the previous afternoon, had shadowed him to Wilson's at 3:30 where Mickey had tailed Pete, had followed Yard away at 5 to his residence, had seen people going in and out of the house but had not shadowed any of them, had watched the house until 3 this morning and had returned to the job at 7, and since then had seen nobody go in or out. You'll have to drop this and take a plant on Wilson's, I said. I hear Whisper Thaler's holding up there, and I'd like an eye kept on him till I make up my mind whether to turn him up for Noonan or not. Dick nodded and started the engine grinding. I got out and returned to the hotel. There was a telegram from the old man. Send by first mail full explanation of present operation and circumstances under which you accepted it with daily reports to date. I put the telegram in my pocket and hoped things would keep on breaking fast. To have sent him the dope he wanted at that time would have been the same as sending in my resignation. I bent a fresh collar around my neck and trotted over to the city hall.
Hello, Noonan greeted me. I was hoping you'd show up.
Tried to get you at your hotel, but they told me you hadn't been in.
He wasn't looking well this morning, but under his glad-handing, he seemed, for a change, genuinely glad to see me. As I sat down, one of his phones rang. He put the receiver to his ear, said, Yes? Listened for a moment, said, You'd better go out there yourself, Mac. And had to make 2 attempts to get the receiver back on its prong before he succeeded. His face had gone a little doughy, but his voice was almost normal as he told me,
Lou Yard's been knocked off. Shot coming down his front steps just now.
Any details? I asked while I cursed myself for having pulled Dick Foley away from Painter Street an hour too soon. That was a tough break. Noonan shook his head, staring at his lap. Shall we go out and look at the remains? I suggested, getting up. He neither got up nor looked up. No, he said wearily to his lap.
To tell you the truth, I don't want to. I don't know as I could stand it just now. I'm getting sick of this killing. It's getting to me.
On my nerves, I mean. I sat down again, considered his low spirits, and asked, "Who do you guess killed him?"
"God knows," he mumbled. "Everybody's killing everybody. Where's it gonna end?"
"Think Reno did it?" Noonan winced, started to look up at me, changed his mind, and repeated, "God knows." I went at him from another angle. "Anybody knocked off in the battle at the Silver Arrow last night?"
"Only 3.
"Who were they?"
"A pair of Johnson brothers named Blackie Whalen and Put Collings that only got out on bail around 5 yesterday. And Dutch Jake Wall, a gorilla."
"What was it all about?"
"Just a roughhouse, I guess. It seems that Put and Blackie and the others that got out with them were celebrating with a lot of friends, and it wound up in smoke."
"All of them Lou Yard's men?"
"I don't know anything about that," he said.
I got up, said, "Oh, all right," and started for the door.
"Wait," he called. "Don't run off like that."
"I guess they were." I came back to my chair. Noonan watched the top of his desk. His face was gray, flabby, damp, like fresh putty.
"Whispers staying at Wilson's," I told him. He jerked his head up. His eyes darkened. Then his mouth twitched, and he let his head sag again. His eyes faded.
"I can't go through with it," he mumbled. "I'm sick of this butchering. I can't stand any more of it."
"Sick enough to give up the idea of evening the score for Tim's killing if it'll make peace?" I asked.
"I am."
"That's what started it," I reminded him. "If you're willing to call it off, it ought to be possible to stop it."
He raised his face and looked at me with eyes that were like a dog's looking at a bone.
"The others ought to be as sick of it as you are," I went on.
"Tell them how you feel about it. Have a get-together and make peace."
"They'd think I was up to some kind of a trick," he objected miserably.
"Have the meeting at Wilson's. Whispers camping there. You'd be the one risking tricks going there."
"Are you afraid of that?"
He frowned and asked.
"Will you go with me?"
"If you want me."
"Thanks," he said. I'll try it.
Chapter 19. The Peace Conference. All the other delegates to the peace conference were on hand when Noonan and I arrived at Wilson's home at the appointed time, 9 o'clock that night. Everybody nodded to us, but the greetings didn't go any further than that. Pete the Finn was the only one I hadn't met before. The bootlegger was a big-boned man of 50 with a completely bald head. His forehead was small, his jaws enormous, wide, heavy, bulging with muscle. We sat around Wilson's library table. Old Elihu sat at the head. The short-clipped hair on his round pink skull was like silver in the light. His round blue eyes were hard, domineering under bushy white brows. His mouth and chin were horizontal lines. On his right, Pete the Finn sat watching everybody with tiny black eyes that never moved. Reno Starkey sat next to the bootlegger. Reno's sallow horse face was as stolidly dull as his eyes. Max Thaler was tilted back in a chair on Wilson's left. The little gambler's carefully pressed pants legs were carelessly crossed. A cigarette hung from one corner of his tight-lipped mouth. I sat next to Thaler. Noonan sat on my other side. Elihu Wilson opened the meeting. He said things couldn't go on the way they were going. We were all sensible men, reasonable men, grown men who had seen enough of the world to know that a man couldn't have everything his own way, no matter who he was. Compromises were things everybody had to make sometimes. To get what he wanted, a man had to give other people what they wanted. He said he was sure that what we all most wanted now was to stop this insane killing. He said he was sure that everything could be frankly discussed and settled in an hour without turning Personville into a slaughterhouse. It wasn't a bad oration. When it was over, there was a moment of silence. Thaler looked past me, at Noonan, as if he expected something of him. The rest of us followed his example, looking at the chief of police.
Noonan's face turned red and he spoke huskily.
Whisper, I'll forget you killed Tim.
He stood up and held out a beefy paw.
Here's my hand on it.
Thaler's thin mouth curved into a vicious smile.
Your bastard of a brother needed killing, but I didn't kill him, he whispered coldly.
Red became purple in the chief's face. I said loudly, Wait, Noonan. We're going at this wrong. We won't get anywhere unless everybody comes clean. Otherwise, we'll all be worse off than before. McSwain killed Tim, and you know it. He stared at me with dumbfounded eyes. He gaped. He couldn't understand what I had done to him. I looked at the others, tried to look virtuous as hell, asked,
That's settled, isn't it? Let's get the rest of the kicks squared.
I addressed Pete the Finn. How do you feel about yesterday's accident to your warehouse and the four men?
One hell of an accident, he rumbled.
I explained. Noonan didn't know you were using the joint. He went there thinking it empty, just to clear the way for a job in town. Your men shot first, and then he really thought he had stumbled into Thaler's hideout. When he found he'd been stepping in your puddle, he lost his head and touched the place off. Thaler was watching me with a hard, small smile in eyes and mouth. Reno was all dull stolidity. Elihu Wilson was leaning toward me, his old eyes sharp and wary. I don't know what Noonan was doing. I couldn't afford to look at him. I was in a good spot if I played my hand right, and in a terrible one if I didn't.
The men, they get paid for taking chances, Pete the Finn said. For the other, 25 grand will make it right.
Noonan spoke quickly, eagerly.
All right, Pete, all right. I'll give it to you.
I pushed my lips together to keep from laughing at the panic in his voice. I could look at him safely now. He was licked, broken, willing to do anything to save his fat neck, or to try. I looked at him. He wouldn't look at me. He sat down and looked at nobody. He was busy trying to look as if he didn't expect to be carved apart before he got away from these wolves to whom I had handed him. I went on with the work, turning to Elihu Wilson.
Do you want to squawk about your bank being knocked over, or do you like it?
Max Thaler touched my arm and suggested,
We could tell better maybe who's entitled to beef if you'd give us what you've got first.
I was glad to. Noonan wanted to nail you, I told him, but he either got word or expected to get word from Yard and Wilson here to let you alone. So he thought if he had the bank looted and framed you for it, your backers would ditch you and let him go after you right. Yard, I understand, was supposed to put his okay on all the capers in town. You'd be cutting into his territory and jipping Wilson. That's how it would look, and that was supposed to make them hot enough that they'd help Noonan cop you. He didn't know you were here. Reno and his mob were in the can. Reno was Yard's pup, but he didn't mind crossing up his head man. He already had the idea that he was about ready to take the burg away from Lou. I turned to Reno and asked, Isn't that it? He looked at me woodenly and said, You're telling it. I continued telling it. Noonan fakes a tip that you're at Cedar Hill and takes all the coppers he can't trust out there with him, even cleaning the traffic detail out of Broadway so Reno would have a clear road. McGraw and the bulls that are in on the play let Reno and his mob sneak out of the hoosegow, pull the job, and duck back in. Nice thing in alibis. Then they got sprung on bail a couple of hours later. It looks as if Lou Yard tumbled. He sent Dutch Jake Wall and some other boys out to the Silver Arrow last night to teach Reno and his pals not to take things in their own hands like that. But Reno got away and got back to the city. It was either him or Lou then. He made sure which it would be by being in front of Lou's house with a gun when Lou came out this morning. Reno seems to have had the right dope, because I noticed that right now
He's holding down a chair that would have been Lou Yard's if Lou hadn't been put on ice. Everybody was sitting very still, as if to call attention to how still they were sitting. Nobody could count on having any friends among those present. It was no time for careless motions on anybody's part. If what I said meant anything one way or the other to Reno, he didn't show it. Thaler whispered softly,
"Didn't you skip some of it?"
"You mean the part about Jerry?" I kept on being the life of the party. I was coming back to that. I don't know whether he got away from the can when you crushed out and was caught later, or whether he didn't get away, or why. And I don't know how willingly he went along on the bank caper. But he did go along, and he was dropped and left in front of the bank because he was your right bower, and his being killed there would pin the trick to you. He was kept in the car till the getaway was on. Then he was pushed out and was shot in the back. He was facing the bank with his back to the car when he got his. Thaler looked at Reno and whispered,
"Well?"
Reno looked with dull eyes at Thaler and asked calmly, "What of it?" Thaler stood up, said,
"Deal me out,"
and walked to the door. Pete the Finn stood up, leaning on the table with big bony hands, speaking from deep in his chest.
"Whisper."
And when Thaler had stopped and turned to face him,
"I'm telling you this. You, Whisper, and all of you. That damn gun work is out. All of you understand it. You've got no brains to know what is best for yourselves, so I'll tell you. This busting the town up is no good for business. I won't have it anymore. You be nice boys, or I'll make you. I got one army of young fellows that know what to do on any end of a gun. I gotta have them in my racket. If I got to use them on you, I'll use them on you. You want to play with gunpowder and dynamite? I'll show you what playing is. You got a fight? I'll give you fighting. Mind what I tell you, that's all."
Pete the Finn sat down. Thaler looked thoughtful for a moment and went away without saying or showing what he had thought. His going made the others impatient. None wanted to remain until anybody else had time to accumulate a few guns in the neighborhood. In a very few minutes, Elihu Wilson and I had the library to ourselves. We sat and looked at one another. Presently, he said,
"How would you like to be chief of police?"
"No, I'm a rotten errand boy."
"I don't mean with this bunch. After we've got rid of them."
"And got another just like them?"
"Damn you," he said. "It wouldn't hurt to take a nicer tone to a man old enough to be your father."
"Who curses me and hides behind his age?" Anger brought a vein out blue in his forehead. Then he laughed.
"You're a nasty talking lad," he said. "But I can't say you haven't done what I paid you to do."
"A swell lot of help I've got from you."
"Did you need wet nursing? I gave you the money and a free hand. That's what you asked for. What more did you want?"
"You old pirate," I said. "I blackmailed you into it. And you played against me all the way till now, when even you can see that they're all hell-bent on gobbling each other up. Now you talk about what you did for me."
"Old pirate," he repeated. "Son, if I hadn't been a pirate, I'd still be working for the Anaconda for wages. And there'd be no Personville Mining Corporation. You're a damned little woolly lamb yourself, I suppose." "I was had, son, where the hair was short. There were things I didn't like, worse things that I didn't know about until tonight. But I was caught and had to bide my time. Why, since that Whisper Thaler has been here, I've been a prisoner in my own home, a damned hostage."
"Tough. Where do you stand now?" I demanded. "Are you behind me?"
"If you win."
I got up and said, "I hope to Christ you get caught with them."
he said. I reckon you do, but I won't. He squinted his eyes merrily at me. I'm financing you. That shows I mean well, don't it? Don't be too hard on me, son. I'm kind of, I said. Go to hell, and walked out.
Chapter 20. Laudanum. Dick Foley in his hired car was at the next corner. I had him drive me over to within a block of Dinah Brand's house and walked the rest of the way.
You look tired, she said when I had followed her into the living room. Been working?
Attending a peace conference out of which at least a dozen killings ought to grow. The telephone rang. She answered it and called me. Reno Starkey's voice.
I thought maybe you'd like to hear about Noonan being shot to hell and gone when he got out of his heap in front of his house. You never saw anybody that was deader. Must have had 30 pills pumped in him.
Thanks. Dinah's big blue eyes asked questions. First fruits of the peace conference, plucked by Whisper Thaler, I told her. Where's the gin?
Reno talking, wasn't it?
Yeah. He thought I'd like to hear about Poisonville being all out of police chiefs.
You mean?
Noonan went down tonight, according to Reno. Haven't you got any gin? Or do you like making me ask for it?
You know where it is.
Been up to some of your cute tricks? I went back into the kitchen, opened the top of the refrigerator, and attacked the ice with an ice pick that had a 6-inch all-sharp blade set in a round blue-and-white handle. The girls stood in the doorway and asked questions. I didn't answer them while I put ice, gin, lemon juice, and seltzer together in 2 glasses.
What have you been doing?
She demanded as we carried our drinks into the dining room.
You look ghastly.
I put my glass on the table, sat down facing it, and complained, This damned Berg's getting me. If I don't get away soon, I'll be going blood simple like the natives. There's been what? 12.5 murders since I've been here? Donald Wilson, Ike Bush, the 4 Wops and the Dick at Cedar Hill, Jerry, Lou Yard, Dutch Jake, Blackie Whalen and Put Collings at the Silver Arrow, Big Nick, the copper I potted, the blonde kid Whisper dropped here, Yakima Shorty, old Elihu's prowler, and now Noonan. That's 16 of them in less than a week, and more coming up. She frowned at me and said sharply,
Don't look like that.
I laughed and went on. I've arranged a killing or two in my time when they were necessary, but this is the first time I've ever got the fever. It's this damned Berg. You can't go straight here. I got myself tangled at the beginning. When old Elihu ran out on me, there was nothing I could do but try to set the boys against each other. I had to swing the job the best way I could. How could I help it if the best way was bound to lead to a lot of killing? The job couldn't be handled any other way without Elihu's backing.
Well, if you couldn't help it, what's the use of making a lot of fuss over it? Drink your drink.
I drank half of it and felt the urge to talk some more. Play with murder enough, and it gets you one of 2 ways. It makes you sick, or you get to like it. It got Noonan the first way. He was green around the gills after Yard was knocked off, all the stomach gone out of him, willing to do anything to make peace. I took him in, suggested that he and the other survivors get together and patch up their differences. We had the meeting at Wilson's tonight. It was a nice party. Pretending I was trying to clear away everybody's misunderstandings by coming clean all around, I stripped Noonan naked and threw him to them, him and Reno. That broke up the meeting. Whisper declared himself out. Pete told everybody where they stood. He said battling was bad for his bootlegging racket, and anybody who started anything from then on could expect to have his booze guards turned loose on them. Whisper didn't look impressed. Neither did Reno.
They wouldn't be, the girl said. What did you do to Noonan? I mean, how did you strip him and Reno?
I told the others that he had known all along that McSwain killed Tim. That was the only lie I told them. Then I told them about the bank stick-up being turned by Reno and the chief, with Jerry taken along and dropped on the premises to tie the job to Whisper. I knew that's the way it was if what you told me was right, about Jerry getting out of the car, starting toward the bank and being shot. The hole was in his back. Fitting in with that, McGraw said the last scene of the stick-up car was when it turned into King Street. The boys would be